Hello, I'm Fred Stella, president of the Interfaith Dialogue Association. Welcome to another edition of Common Threads. Last week, we began our conversation with Dr. Jonathan Dudley. He wrote a book a few years ago entitled Broken Words, The Abuse of Science and Faith in American Politics. And he'll be coming to Grand Rapids on September 30th to talk about the abortion issue. Dr. Dudley will give a presentation at Woodlawn Christian Reformed Church Ministry Center Monday evening. Again, this is September 30th, 7:30 p.m. It is free and open to the public. And again, we'll be discussing the abortion issue from an enlightened perspective. At least that's what some people think. A little bit about Dr. Dudley. He graduated with honors from Calvin College as a biology major, went on to earn his master's in ethics from Yale University's Divinity School, and an MD from Johns Hopkins School of Medicine. He is presently a postdoctoral fellow at the Ludwig Center at the Johns Hopkins Hospital. And again, this talk happening at the Woodlawn Ministry Center is located at 3190 Burton, and it is right across the street from the entrance to Calvin College. We welcome once again to Common Threads, Dr. Jonathan Dudley. Hello, Jonathan.
Hello, Fred. Thanks for having me.
Certainly. Last week, we ended our conversation talking about what the Bible may or may not say about the issue of abortion. And we were running out of time. I also wanted to ask about the Talmud. I realized that the Talmud does not affect the theological thinking of most Christians, but I was curious because you do address it in your book. How does the Talmud understand the issue of life in the womb and
Sure.
the termination of that?
Well, I think I think it's a big set of writings. And there, I think in general, the Jewish tradition sees abortion as problematic, morally problematic, and perhaps wrong in even most circumstances, but also reflects a belief based partly on a passage in Exodus, as well as one in Genesis, that personhood or full moral life begins at birth. And so there's a passage in the Talmud that talks about a scenario where a woman has difficulty in childbirth. It's actually pretty graphic. It says, one dismembers the embryo within her limb from limb because her life takes precedence over its life. Then it says, once the head or the greater part has emerged, it may not be touched because we do not set aside one life for another. And I think that partly reflects the idea that life begins with breath, which there's a passage in Genesis 2:7 that's often that talks about God forming Adam and how he became a living being when God breathed into his nostrils. But I think it reflects partly that verse as well as the one I mentioned in Exodus.
And you say that it is hyperbole to say that life begins at conception and ends at birth, but you think that a lot of people who wish to criminalize all abortion or most abortion might hold that understanding to some degree. Can you explain?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is perhaps not entirely a fair characterization of their views, but I also think that folks who are opposed to abortion tend to be very focused on the situation where you have a woman facing an unintended pregnancy and kind of trying to make sure she makes a choice consistent with their values in that context. But I think it would be very helpful to expand the focus to talk about how we prevent that scenario in the first place and how we support people when they're in that scenario beyond just maybe providing some diapers for them at a crisis pregnancy center, but, with social programs that will help make it realistic for them to have a child they may not be able to afford.
You know, one thing that I've not heard in this whole debate is the idea, well, certainly a great number of people do believe that if one is raped and one becomes pregnant, that abortion should be open to them. But there's also that gray area that, for instance, some women are in relationships where they are overly controlled by their partners, their male partners. And the freedom, if you will, to exercise birth control, the freedom to say yes or no to any sort of sexual activity really doesn't exist, or exists minimally. At the same time, in a court of law, you wouldn't be able to prove that as rape. Do you see where I'm going
here?
Sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when someone becomes pregnant because of that sort of activity, my heart just goes out to that woman, because oftentimes what that means is they're just anchored deeper and deeper into an extremely dysfunctional and most likely abusive, whether it's emotionally or physical, relationship. It's just, again, something you don't hear about. And oftentimes you tend to get these scenarios painted by the pro-life side as being just women out on a jaunt having a frivolous dalliance, and then, oops, look what I did, or look what we did. And I don't believe that to be the case in most instances. I could be wrong, but I really don't think that is, that women just sort of use abortion as a form of birth control, if you will. Just like, oh, I don't have any protection tonight, but, you know, I can always just take care of this.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that's actually a good reflection of something I mentioned last week, that both sides of the debate actually don't really think about abortion the way they're commonly understood to. So just to take both those scenarios, so in the case of rape, you know, a lot of people who are pro-life support exceptions for rape. Almost all Republican politicians do, which doesn't really make sense. If you think it's abortion is killing a person, you wouldn't kill someone just because, you know, maybe they cause you depression or came into existence through bad circumstances. On the other hand, if you thought it was just a blob of tissue, then why not just rely on abortion for contraception? And, you know, I think that's, you know, I think that, you know, most women actually prefer to rely on contraception instead of abortion to control reproduction because of some acknowledgement on some level that it's preferable morally.
Clearly. What are the disparate ideas of contraception in the early church, now that we're on contraception?
Well, I would say that throughout the Christian tradition, there has been a very strong opposition to anything that interferes with the assumed procreative purpose of sex, which includes very strong opposition to both abortion and contraception. There are some nuances to that. So actually, I would say the majority of Christian theologians in the past did not believe that full moral life begins at conception. They believed it began at formation, when the developing embryo or fetus became sufficiently developed. But they still opposed abortion before that point, out of the belief that, you know, for similar reasons to their opposition to contraception, that kind of interferes with the procreative purpose of sex or the creative work of God. And Catholics, of course, have maintained these beliefs, and the beliefs are often somewhat surprising to us. So, for example, John Calvin compares abortion to contraception and calls both of them killing. He talks about an episode in the Bible where a man named Onan basically pulls out when he's having sex and spills his seed on the ground, and he calls this a crime, like a heinous crime that's similar to abortion. So I think most people don't actually believe that, even if they're opposed to contraception, that it's a form of killing and a horrific crime. But that was what most Christians believed previously. in the 1950s, evangelicals and Protestants began to rethink the opposition to contraception. And most institutions, such as Calvin College, for example, are not morally opposed to contraception in principle anymore. And so the context in which they think about abortion is somewhat changed because of that.
Were there any movements that were more liberal that you're aware of in the earlier church?
You know, it's arguable that the early church was perhaps more attuned to the social context in which people might encounter these scenarios, with more concern about taking care of each other's needs and helping the poor. You know, with regards to the moral status of the fetus, as I mentioned, figures like Thomas Aquinas argued that a certain level of development has to be achieved before it actually becomes equivalent to killing a person. More recently, I believe I mentioned last week that most evangelicals in the late 1960s understood the Bible as teaching that life begins at birth, based on a passage in Exodus I had mentioned.
Yes.
So there's some surprising twists and turns in the Christian tradition that provide a basis for perhaps thinking somewhat differently about these issues.
When it comes to these issues, for instance, in the book, you quote several Catholic theologians. Do Protestants pay attention to that?
Well, I think that in many ways, the popular evangelical thought on abortion is completely derivative of the Catholic Church's teaching on the subject, which is that there's a right to life from the moment of conception. And I think that's due partly to just a political alliance and a desire to, you know, have political organizations that are united in what they're advocating for. In the 1980s, Protestants, evangelicals began reinterpreting the Bible from teaching that life begins at birth to teaching the position of the Catholic Church. And previously, Catholics had relied more on natural law arguments and scientific arguments to establish their beliefs. But for evangelicals to appropriate those beliefs, they needed a way to convince people who want to live by the Bible alone, or at least think they are, that the Bible teaches the church's beliefs. So that's where you have a lot of the, I would argue, strained arguments that the Bible teaches that life begins at conception. Kind of an attempt to provide an evangelical rationale for a Catholic belief that actually originated due to natural law and other arguments.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Common Threads on WGVU-FM. I'm Fred Stella, and with me today, Dr. Jonathan Dudley. We're talking about his upcoming appearance here in Grand Rapids on September 30th. He is the author of Broken Words, The Abuse of Science and Faith in American Politics. You write about something that surprised me a great deal, that early on in this country, abortion was available up to 5 months. What was the mindset there?
Well, that reflects the belief that I had talked about with Aquinas and others, that the soul is united with the body at some point during gestation. So that was the official teaching of the church, the Catholic Church, until the 1800s. And that was reflected in somewhat modified forms in the laws of different more Protestant countries. But specifically, with regards to that, those early laws, it reflected beliefs that the fetus becomes alive at quickening, when it's felt to move by the mother.
And you also talk about abortion in the 19th century, and you write about certain ethnocentric issues, such as concern about Catholics taking over the country, which is interesting because we hear the same thing now about Muslims, because Muslims often have large families, although not here in the United States. I don't know any, you know, 10 child families who are Muslim.
Talk about how abortion play and birth control, if you will, played into the national fabric in the 19th century.
Yeah, well, there's kind of a debate between historians. In the mid to late 1800s, there was a campaign to make abortion illegal in the United States that succeeded, and so it was illegal for a period of time up until Roe v. Wade. Somewhat surprisingly, evangelicals were not meaningfully involved in that campaign. It was led by other people, such as physicians. There's debate among historians as to what motivated that claim. Typically, more pro-life folks argue that it was due to a belief among physicians that the quickening criteria is arbitrary and that the fetus is alive before that point. Pro-choice folks have argued that, in fact, it was driven, in part at least, by a concern that Catholic immigrants were out-reproducing their mainly Protestant social group. So abortion was depleting the numbers of Protestants.
And according to your research, integration versus segregation plays a big role about how we feel, or perhaps how we felt a few decades ago. Could you explain that?
So are you referring to like the 1970s?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, so... So somewhat surprisingly, evangelicals, Catholics have been very opposed to abortion, with the official teaching of the church that you should treat the embryo as a person from conception since the late 1800s. But evangelicals, kind of when the abortion issue was coming to a head in the late 1960s, early 1970s, evangelicals kind of saw it as a Catholic issue. They didn't really buy the natural law arguments that Catholics were making. They thought the Bible taught life begins at birth. They weren't supportive, of unrestricted abortion, and I think they saw it as problematic for different reasons, but they weren't leading the pro-life movement. They're kind of on the sidelines. So one factor that awakened evangelicals to become more politically active is that around that time period, the civil rights movement occurred, and the government attempted to censure an evangelical college, Bob Jones University, that forbade interracial dating, and argued that that violated the civil rights movement, or I'm sorry, this the some civil rights law, and that was viewed as basically a government intrusion into the evangelical community as an attack on the religious liberty of this evangelical college. And that was one factor, I wouldn't say it's the only one, but one factor that prompted evangelicals to become more politically active, to kind of fend off what they viewed as government intrusion. So to just provide some evidence for that, Paul Weyrich was an individual who co-founded the Moral Majority with Jerry Falwell, which is the biggest religious right advocacy group that was founded in 1979. And he states, what galvanized the Christian community was not abortion, school prayer, or the Equal Rights Amendment. I was trying to get those people interested in those issues, and I utterly failed. What changed their minds was Jimmy Carter's intervention against the Christian schools, trying to deny them tax-exempt status on the basis of so-called de facto segregation. So this kind of a problematic element to how evangelicals became politically active. I think it's simplistic to say that was the only factor, but at the same time, I think it needs to be acknowledged, especially in our current context, where we're seeing some of the same indifference to racism from the evangelical community.
This is true.
It's something that is not entirely new in that community.
According to the research you have here, 50 to 70% of all embryos die in utero. And you say that the pro-life community should be reacting to this. How should they react if this is a natural occurrence?
Well, it's kind of a surprising fact that's been discovered more recently, but yeah, it turns out that the majority of embryos are spontaneously miscarried, and that's due to a number of factors. But I think to be consistent, they should react the same way that we react to other diseases that kill people that we think are persons or have full moral value. So, you know, reacting to cancer, for example, which is another natural cause of death, as a society, we've allocated billions, if not trillions of dollars over decades to try to understand that disease and try to make progress in saving lives and curing people. And so I think if you see the embryo as morally equivalent to a child or an adult, then I think you should be committed to seeing this massive loss of life as one of the most catastrophic or one of the greatest moral problems of our age. It's by far the number one cause of death in human history. And especially if you believe that, these embryos have the same moral status as children, you would have a unique obligation to raise awareness of this fact and try to mobilize people to try to understand this better and come up with cures and ways to prevent it. So I think it's kind of another thing. The fact that no pro-life organization has done those things, I think also kind of points to the point I had made earlier, that I think, if you really examine the beliefs and practices on both sides, I think it doesn't make sense of the practices of pro-life organizations to see them as motivated by the belief that abortion really is equal to killing a person. So I think it kind of reflects somewhat of an inconsistency in how they approach that issue.
Sure. Let's end the program with a few questions about you and your work. So, for instance, I'm fascinated about your academic track. So you have a degree in biology from Calvin College here in Grand Rapids. Then you go to Yale and get an MA in ethics. And from their divinity school, I'm just curious what your trajectory was at that time.
Yeah, well, I'd always intended to go to medical school. I happened to finish my studies at Calvin a year early and felt that it would be interesting to take a brief detour and think more about these bioethical issues. So that's what led me to Yale. And while I was at Yale, I was also doing some medical research at the medical school there. But yeah, it's just kind of a brief detour or a break in some ways before medical school. But I think it's been interesting. I think it's given me a different perspective on some of the issues.
And what does your work consist of these days for the most part?
Well, my clinical training is in a fairly narrow field called molecular genetic pathology, and that focuses on using genetic information to guide patient care. And all of my research focuses on developing genetics-based tests to detect cancer and other diseases. So I spend almost all my time doing research in genetics.
And something you mentioned last week, and it just hit me right now, you talked about embryonic research, and you mentioned that I believe the cutoff point for work with embryos is 14 days. Is that what you said?
Yeah, I believe that's true.
Okay. I didn't realize we were still doing that. I thought that was criminalized by the W. Bush administration. Not true, eh?
Well, I think the Bush administration, even they didn't fully criminalize it. They just prevented new lines from being made. So even during the Bush administration, it's permissible to use embryonic stem cell lines that had previously been created, but not to create new ones.
And how about now?
To be honest, I don't work in that area, so I don't have a great understanding. But I do believe it's continuing to proceed. I think the Obama administration relaxed regulations on human embryonic stem cell research, and I think that, you know, kind of opened the floodgates in some ways to create many more lines. I know pro-life groups have been frustrated with the Trump administration for not doing more to regulate that area.
Really?
But
that surprises me. I thought he was at their beck and call. No, seriously.
It is kind of surprising on this issue.
Huh. Okay. Very good. Well, and let's also talk about your appearance. Again, this will be Monday evening, September 30th, and it's going to take place at the Woodlawn Ministry Center, which is located at 3190 Burton, right across the street from Calvin College. And the relationship between your appearance and Calvin College is, it's not exact. That is to say, this is not a Calvin College production or presentation, but Woodlawn Christian Reformed Church meets on the campus of Calvin College, and they are your sponsors, correct?
That's correct, yes.
Okay, wonderful. Well, I look forward to meeting there. I'm going to be there myself. As a matter of fact, I'll be moderating the Q&A period, if someone hasn't told you all that yet.
Okay, great.
So thanks once again. We will see you soon.
All right.
This has been Common Threads here on WGVU. I'm Fred Stella. Our guest today, Jonathan Dudley. Broken Words, The Abuse of Science and Faith in American Politics is his book. And we'll see you next week here on WGVU.